You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer specializing in food and science. Now, this podcast is fantastic. It's all about the future of meat. Now, we all know that as countries become wealthier, more of the population identifies as middle class, meat consumption tends to rise. But have we reached peak meat here in the UK? Because in an age when meat alternatives have exploded in popularity, veganism has gone large, and the CO2 equivalent emissions of livestock are a huge issue. What does the future hold? Well, we have an amazing panel here in the studio and joining us online. We've got Shefali Sharma, the Director of the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy.
Hello.
We have Ursula Ahrens, member of the British Dietetic Association.
Hello.
Patrick Holden, founder and chief exec of the Sustainable Food Trust.
Hello.
And Jimmy Woodrow, representing the Pasture Fed Livestock Association.
Hello.
Now, let's start off with Patrick. Can you just give us a bit of groundwork here? What are the issues at stake here when we're talking about the future of meat? Who are the stakeholders? Stake, obviously, being the operative word. What do we need to be aware of? Which issues?
Well, I think the background to this conversation is that just about all over the world, everyone is asking a very similar question today, which is, what should I eat to be sustainable and healthy? We're all aware that the greenhouse gas emissions are exceeding the capacity of the planet to avoid a descent into unlivable conditions, of the biodiversity loss, and of the pressure on food security relating to an expanding population. And we want to get our diets right. And a succession of recent reports, notably the Eat Lancet report and several reports since, have all urged us to cut down dramatically on our meat consumption. And most of the reports are suggesting that the main culprit is red meat, or in other words, meat from sheep and cattle, because they emit large quantities of methane, which is a potent greenhouse gas. So if you look at the trends in meat consumption in the UK, for instance, but I think this is being mirrored in most developed countries, they are dramatically down. And particularly red meat, lamb and beef consumption is down, whereas paradoxically, chicken production is actually going up. So we need to ask ourselves the question, is this right? And does this reflect the reality of the farmers' need to farm in line with planetary boundaries and to rebuild the soil carbon, which has been lost during most of my farming lifetime, which is the industrial farming chapter.
Okay. Now, you're a dairy farmer and a cheesemaker as well, but you're very much an organic farming advocate, and you've got your CBE to show for it as well. What impact does all the change have on the whole world of livestock?
Well, in my opinion, and of course, I should declare an interest, as you rightly say, I'm a dairy farmer and a cheesemaker, and also have grown vegetables in the past, and also we grow grain, which we feed to our cows. But in my opinion, sustainably managed livestock will need to play an absolutely central role in the development of the more sustainable food systems that we need to replace the ones we've got at the moment. And the problem, I think, is that the public is very confused, and most people have failed to differentiate between the livestock which are part of the problem and those which are part of the solution. Because there's no doubt we do need to cut down on our meat consumption, but which meat? That is the question. And I think this blanket debate, which is less meat, is actually adding to a lot of existing confusion, and people are making the wrong choices. Most people think, if you ask them, a lot of young people in the street just stopped and said, which meat do you think would be the worst in terms of impact on the climate? They'd all say beef and lamb, red meat. And in fact, if the livestock are managed correctly, not only will they help the farmers to rebuild the soil carbon, which we've lost during the intensive farming period, but also the contribution that methane emissions make towards climate change has been exaggerated. And this has recently been shown to be true by academics at Oxford University, who have recalculated the methane emissions from ruminant livestock and found that it was nowhere near as bad as was previously supposed. So there's a lot of academic influence here. And I would say that most of the authors of these reports don't really understand agriculture.
Yeah, certainly the methane emissions, the calculations of that have changed enormously. Do you have a handle on what the figures are now? Can you remember them off the top of your head?
Well, the Livestock's Long Shadow report, which was published in 2008 and then updated in 2013, made an indication that I think methane is more potent by, I think, a factor of 23 or something like that than CO2. And what the Oxford University Professor Miles Allen has done is he's recalculated the impact, taking into account the fact that methane degrades when it goes into the atmosphere over a certain time period. And previously, that calculation was not factored in, as a result of which ruminant animals have got a much worse press than they actually should have done. It also needs to be remembered that ruminant animals have been emitting methane for as long as there have been herbivores on the planet. It's a closed part of the carbon cycle. The new methane is actually coming from fossil fuel consumption, and of course, we're all guilty of that.
Okay, now, Shefali, if you can do me a favour, can you shed light on what the changes are? Because you're looking at policy. Now, this is really working about what's going to happen and what should be done. So we're looking at the future, really. What changes can be done to make things better?
Sure. I think one of the most important things is to recognize that there's an industrial system of agriculture which differs very dramatically from other forms of agriculture where you have local food hubs, where you have more decentralized food systems, where there are relationships between producers and consumers. And the role that agribusiness has played, particularly in the last 20 to 30 years, has so significantly changed the food system in a way that's highly emitting. I mean, one of the other major reports that came out last year is the IPCC report on land, which says that, you know, our food system emits anywhere between 24 to 37% of the world's global emissions. And that's a real problem. So how do we address this from a food system perspective and not just like going after beef or going after chicken or going after pork? And the first place to start is to really start looking at agribusiness, like we look at fossil fuel companies, and to understand that they're completely off the hook. They're off the hook in the sense that there's hardly any public scrutiny or any policies that are targeting agribusiness accounting and transparency of their operations. Right now we have, something called the Carbon Disclosure Project, where companies can voluntarily report their emissions and say what they're doing. And then the Carbon Disclosure Project gives them an A or a B or a C, depending on what these companies are self-reporting. And the notion that we can't even know the number of animals, you know, big companies like Cargill or Tyson or Moy Park slaughter, that this is a hard data to even get is the first place to start. We need transparency about how much these companies are slaughtering, what their supply chain looks like, where the emissions in their supply chain. So far, the discussions around emissions related to the livestock industry focuses on farmers and consumers and leaves out the big elephant in the room, which is agribusiness.
Yeah. So do you think that self-disclosure is pointless and that this should be part of policy, that firms should disclose?
I think they should disclose. I think self-disclosure is a good first step, but by the crisis that we're facing requires governments to mandate that companies disclose and that there be streamlining, right? Like there should be a set of categories of things that they should be disclosing. Right now, companies can disclose what they feel like. And yeah, the public has the right to know.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and let's bring in Jimmy here. Now, let's talk a little bit about your role in the Pasture-Fed Livestock Association. What does the Pasture-Fed Livestock Association sort of advise? What's the plan for the future for you? to make things better or just to survive?
I think kind of picking up on something that Patrick mentioned, I think it's about showing that farmers can be part of the solution to global warming. We have farmers who are evidencing that they're sequestering carbon on their farms through, you know, effectively photosynthesis and managed grazing. And also that by looking at things bottom up rather than top down, we can grow local food systems to not completely take over from agribusiness. I don't think anyone's suggesting that supermarkets are suddenly going to evaporate overnight, but I think there's a growing movement of farmers, producers, wholesalers, and consumers who are looking for something different. And I think our organization is part of that groundswell of interest in effectively a different way of operating. Mm.
Can you just unpack for me the concept of pasture fed? Because you can't leave a cow out in the fields all through the year, can you?
Some do. Not everyone does. I think it largely depends on where you are in the country, your soil type, how much rainfall you have, and I think probably your appetite for taking on what is quite a big challenge and keeping them out all year round.
And just to be very specific, we're talking about vets' bills. We're talking about maintaining a food supply through difficult times. Can you paint the picture a little bit?
So pasture fed as a principle is about what the animal is eating, and in effect, that could be indoors or outdoors.
Yeah.
So we will have farmers who are farming to a 100% pasture fed principle who still house their animals indoors through winter.
So creating your own silage from your own pasture
silage,
fits in with the concept.
Exactly. We do have some farmers who do outwinter their animals. Some have the ability to put their animals onto slightly different soil types over winter compared to summer. Mm. That gives them an advantage.
Patrick, have you ever tried keeping your herd out throughout the year?
Well, funnily enough, I have. We've been here on this farm for 47 years. And when we first came, there were no buildings. And we did outwinter our dairy herd for 2 years. But in this part of the world, it rains a lot, West Wales. And so we considered it more sensible to house them for around 6 months of the year, which is what we now do. But the crucial thing about pasture fed is that it's either pasture grazed or pasture conserved as hay or silage or haylage. And all the consumption of the animal will be grass or preserved grass rather than grains, which has already been suggested is actually much more part of the problem. These feedlot beef animals that are very common in the United States are absolutely part of the problem in terms of both greenhouse gas emissions, but also use of scarce resources and pollution and many other things as well.
Yeah, okay. Now, can you give us an explanation of why that is so, Patrick? So I think we bandy around the concept of feedlots being a negative thing, but don't necessarily know the nuts and bolts of why.
Well, I think perhaps the best way for me to describe why it matters so much to differentiate between the sustainably managed livestock and those which are really part of the problem is to start first by talking about how sustainably managed cattle and sheep can contribute towards the solution, as has just been suggested. They alone, perhaps not alone, but the best way to build soil fertility, indeed to build soil, is with an interaction between ruminant animals, that's cattle and sheep, grazing grass and trampling it in, and the poo and the trampling of the hooves of the cattle and the interaction with the soil is actually the soil creation mechanism. So what farmers have done for millennia is to work with nature to have a crop rotation, or to, in the case of the nomadic pastoralists in Africa, to graze the animals and herd them. And that rotational grazing, which has now been developed into a fine art by people who call it mob grazing or holistic grazing, can actually speed up soil building. And what we need to do now, after a period of about 50 or 60 years, when most of the grains and the vegetables that we eat today have been produced in arable monocultures, just crop after crop, year after year, we've got this soil fertility down to a critical level, is to go back or forward, as I would say, to mixed farming, which is, involves a crop rotation with a fertility building element, probably about 50% of the total crop rotation, which can only be turned into food by grazing it with cattle and sheep, which is why they play such a vital role. So they're soil builders, they're carbon sequesterers, and by the way, the second largest carbon bank in the world is the soil, and it's the only carbon bank that we can easily build in a realistic time scale, say the next 10 to 15 years, thereby actually taking CO2 out of the atmosphere and putting it back in the soil carbon bank. The alternative. Yeah.
Now, just to bring this back to the feedlot concept, so what we're saying here is that the feedlots break this cycle, there's a barrier in the way, and so you get degradation of the soil and an imperfect cycle, a carbon cycle.
Yes, and they're kept in vast lots, thousands of animals, fed mainly grain, mainly genetically modified soy and maize, and their manure is a massive pollution problem and a disposal problem and a pollutant of the air. And where the manure should go, of course, is back into the soil. But when you have that many cattle in a vast feedlot, they're absolutely part of the problem. And then you need to think also of the footprint of the cattle, where they eat. And very often the grain is grown in Argentina or in North America, where there are massive soil erosion problems going on due to over-intensive grain production. So in every possible way, of course, antibiotics has already been mentioned as well. Antibiotics are also part of the problem. In every possible way, beef cattle in feedlots are part of the problem, as are intensive poultry. So many people now, young people in particular, think that it's best, if you want to avoid all this, just to switch to poultry. Industrial poultry production is as big a part of the problem as feedlot beef.
Yeah, okay. Now, I must move on to Ursula in a second because she's been sitting here behaving herself very, very well and not causing any trouble. But just one last question about this and for you, Patrick. And this is the concept that organic farming, and this has been talked about a lot, that people have said that there's not enough land or resources to feed the population of the UK purely on organic meat. Now, is that the case and is that relevant?
Well, I've got the longest established organic dairy farm in Wales, and our yields are going up and our soil fertility is increasing, as is our biodiversity. I think if you look at the reality that 50% of all the food that is grown today is wasted, and is it more than 50% of the population now is overweight or obese? If we were to eat differently and align our future diets to the productive capacity of sustainably farmed land, and I'd rather use that term than organic, because I think organic conjures up a lot of prejudice, I'm quite certain we could feed a peak population, say 10 billion, but we'd have to eat in a different way, and that is the big challenge, to get the public to empower them.
Okay, yeah. And that's another part of the big changes here. Now, Ursula, so what's interesting here is that we're not just talking about CO2 emissions, and we're not just talking about soil degradation. We're talking about concepts like animal welfare, but also health. Now, should this be rolled into the concept of the future of meat, the how it's eaten and its health impact?
Well, you're right to say that it's not just a single issue, and you've mentioned welfare, which a lot of younger people especially feel very strongly about. But you're looking at concepts that are not directly comparable. So ethics and animal welfare is one subject. Carbon production and methane production is another. Use of land and possible destruction of pristine environments, such as happening in Brazil, is another issue. And then you can't put them all together on a single grid and measure them in a single way. But yes, there is this paradox and this tension between producing foods, including producing meats, for optimal efficiency, which means the most protein per acre or whatever measure you want, to feed the 7.7 billion going into 10 billion by 2050, which is how we're doing it at the moment, versus saying, okay, we can still feed a lot of people, but we have to do it in a less intensive way. And that can only result in dramatic increases in the price of food, which is fine if you're affluent and perhaps living in a great country like the UK, but obviously will create huge tensions in other countries that don't have those funds to spend on food production. So it's this tension between the cost of food and with that, the food choices that millions make versus pulling in all these other factors that are important for all of us, which, as I say, includes the ethics and husbandry and good practice and considering soil quality and all these other factors, which all have a price tag to them.
Well, it's a bloody nightmare, isn't it? What's the solution then? No, there isn't a solution here. We're talking just about the concept of the future.
Well, the consensus is for the UK, and if we just stick to the UK for now, the consensus is for most people to consume less meat. Mm. And specifically, for example, the Committee for Climate Change has specifically put the target of 20% reduction in ruminants and dairy. So that's beef, lamb and dairy. And to replace that reduction in meat with plant proteins. So you're not replacing beef with a carrot,
yeah,
because obviously that doesn't work, but looking at plant protein sources that tick off the nutrients, but put a bit less pressure on the environmental systems that are created by meat production.
Okay, so now Shefali, we're talking about changing people's behaviour, we're talking about cost. I mean, these are enormous challenges to tackle. Is it possible to do so?
It's interesting because Patrick mentioned, you know, less meat. Do we really want to say that? Ursula just mentioned we do need less. And I would say less and better is a good kind of way to think about it. If you are supporting farmers like our colleague who is doing pasture raised and Patrick is trying to, you know, do sustainable sources, that is better meat or dairy, as the case may be. And what we need is a mix. I mean, I think if we wait for consumers to change their behavior, I'm not sure that we're going to be able to get to our 10-year timeframe that the IPCC gives us to really rein in our emissions. And again, Patrick points out not just emissions, but also, you know, all the confluence of things interacting with each other, the biodiversity loss, obesity crisis, everything. And so if we want to do this in a concerted and an intelligent manner, we actually need a set of policy measures that, A, on the one hand, take away subsidies to destructive ways of producing meat and dairy. So the industrial production that is subsidized, you know, we have, I mean, with the UK now leaving the European Union, that's it's a whole different ballgame. But certainly in the EU, that's a question of the common agriculture policy and how we change that. And also to actually regulate these emissions and the pollutants that Patrick mentioned, whether it's nitrates or the air pollution that we face with this kind of production. And then also taking into account our imports, the UK and the EU, and the amount of grains that we import from Brazil, for instance, and the deforestation that's taking place there. So I think you need a set of things. You need obviously sound dietary guidelines that help and that are promoted at every level, where people are eating healthy levels and not over consuming meat and dairy and even fish, I would say. And then on the other hand, you need to help producers, those that are doing the right thing, supporting them so that they can actually, you know, continue to stay in business and facilitating a transition from this industrial destructive model of production towards something that is way more sustainable. And
okay, well, if you're talking about concepts of policy, presumably you're talking to government and policymakers. Now, do they actually give a toss, or are they, do they care about their votes, or do they care about the future? I don't see much change at the moment, although we are obviously waiting for a strategy to arrive on our doorstep in the near future. Do they really care, or is it about votes that they care about?
Of course they care about votes. And I think this is the dynamic that we have to change in the next couple of years. But what we also see now is that there's a real vibrant movement on the streets, right? And certainly in the UK, see the Extinction Rebellion. Of course, you can talk about their strategies, sometimes not so great, but you've got like Fridays for Future. You've got a lot of young people coming out on the streets and saying, hey, We have the right to our future. Now that we see this coronavirus explosion, you know, there's a lot being said about wild animal trade, but not much is being said about the massive intensification of animal farming in China and why there are so many pandemics that are created out of such a system. And I think that has been underplayed in looking at the coronavirus. So we see a whole bunch of problems with this. And I think when you see the steps the governments are taking right now, jumping into action on the coronavirus, we know that governments can take action when we realize our future is at stake. So it's a question of how do we mobilize? How do we mobilize public opinion? And how do we get the public to understand, yes, you elect the officials. You can tell them that this issue is critical enough to vote on and to get their votes.
Now, I mean, should we talk about cost here? So, Jimmy, pasture-fed livestock association. I would imagine, and I could be wrong here, that pasture-fed meat costs more than feedlot-raised meat in the short term, I guess.
I would say most of the pasture-fed meat you can find in the market would be at a premium to conventional.
Yes. Now, cost obviously is a big part of this, but do you think that the regulation or legislation should come in to help that? Do you think that there should be, again, we were talking about changing of subsidies and shifting those to be a bit more intelligent. Do you think that, for instance, pasture-fed meat should receive a subsidy?
I think what should happen is that there should be a level playing field so that for farmers who are taking these necessary steps to protect the environment, to protect biodiversity, animal welfare, that they're not being disadvantaged in the market.
Are they currently? I think
the reality is if you're a conventional farmer, you're effectively outsourcing a lot of the costs of your production. So let's say the water company are having to clear the nitrates out of the water that you've pumped onto your fields to grow your grass or to grow your crops. Mm-hmm. That's something that the consumer is paying for, but through taxes rather than through the price of their meat.
Yeah.
And if we can level that playing field, I think we will correct perhaps the story of organic, which still hasn't yet reached 10% of the market. Mm. And that's largely because it's not a level playing field. And I, you know, Patrick used to work for the Soil Association and has now set up a new venture. And I guess my perception of that is until we get some regulation doing this from government, I think in reality, which I think we're starting to see a little bit of in the agriculture bill that was scheduled a few weeks ago. I think until that happens, this is going to be a niche play.
Mm. So you're saying that the cost is higher, the cost of non-organic or non-pasture-fed meat is higher, but it's just consumed into other areas, i.e. tax, subsidies, your water bills, you know, the other things.
I guess the NHS would be a classic case in point. There's some very exciting research coming out, both on meat, but also in the kind of vegetable grain world, that looks at the difference in nutrient density and quality between what a normal consumer would consider to be the same product, so a carrot to a carrot, or a sirloin steak to a sirloin steak. And I think the more that consumers can understand the impact of farming practice on what they're actually eating, which I think at the moment is not in the consumer domain, it's barely in the food production domain. Farmers are talking about it. Mm. I think once we can get that talked about, then all of a sudden, good farming practice will translate into higher nutrients and will translate into a premium.
Okay, this is a slightly controversial area. What's the BDA's take on the idea that food raised in a different system can be more nutritious?
Well,
can organic food be better than non-organic food?
So the question is nutritious. The Food Standards Authority did a huge survey looking at conventionally grown plant products versus organic grown plant products and found minimal differences in terms of nutrient content. So, but some people say it's healthier not just because of difference in nutrient content, but less pesticide application. Mm-hmm. And there have been a number of studies looking at feeding organic versus non-organic to particular vulnerable groups. And some studies show benefits for organic production, but not uniformly and not strongly. So there's a lot of debate about that. And as I say, nutrient content is one thing, but the wider aspects of the environmental benefits of less pesticide use is another. And again, you're then starting to talk chalk and cheese. Generally speaking, an organic carrot and a non-organic carrot contain the same amount of beta carotene or vitamin C or fiber. So, and there might be differences, but they are minimal. Mm-hmm. They're not major differences.
Well, actually, if I might come in here.
I thought that the whales might be fuming there somewhere. Go on, out with it.
No, not fuming, because we haven't had the data. And until really now, the orthodoxy has been that whatever method of production you use, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference to the nutrition. But there's a chap called Dan Kitteridge, who comes from Massachusetts, who has found a piece of space technology which measures the light emissions of different foods, and is developing it as a means of differentiating the nutrient quality of different foods. And he took a kilogram of carrot seed, sent it to 100 growers, asked them all, ranging from organic to intensive conventional, and asked them to grow this seed into carrots and then send the carrots back for laboratory analysis. And he found a vast difference of nutrient density between the best and the worst. And it wasn't necessarily a straight correlation between organic and non-organic. And if we could have a reliable way as consumers of differentiating between the less nutrient dense and the more nutrient dense foods, that would be a real breakthrough. And my hunch is that if you farm in harmony with nature using a traditional crop rotation and you build soil carbon and soil biology, it's almost certain that there will be differences, but we just haven't had the technology to measure them accurately until now. But might I just pick up also the point about pricing? The truth is that our food is dishonestly priced because it doesn't reflect the negative externalities, which is what economists call them. In other words, the damaging impacts of the farming system to climate change, to the destruction of soil organic matter, to public health. So actually, we have dishonest food pricing because of this absence of cost internalization. And the only people that can put that right is governments. We've never applied the polluter pays principle in agriculture. And because of that, it has disadvantaged organic farmers and more sustainable farmers and the pasture-fed people. So they're operating against what you could refer to as an economic headwind. That's why there's been a necessity to charge a premium. So this idea that we can't make these changes towards sustainable farming because what about the people who haven't got enough income to buy that sort of food is frankly a nonsense. We should not hold the debate on those grounds. If there are people for whom the affordability of food is an issue, then governments need to step in and help them. But we shouldn't use that as an argument against getting our food and farming systems inside the limits of the planet's ability to avoid irreversible climate change and biodiversity catastrophe, because we're just deluding ourselves if we carry on in that way.
Yeah.
Now, and if I may jump in here, yeah. Just to add on the nutrition thing, I think with meats and dairy, it's particularly pronounced, the difference, because there's a big difference in nutrition in meat that's produced by grass-fed, in red meat that's produced through grass-fed versus grains. And I mean, you know this from the oleic acid and other things. I mean, you can see grass-fed milk. You know, when you look at milk, you can just actually see the oils floating on the milk. And so there's a big difference. And not to mention in the industrial system, you have a lot of antibiotics and all of that. And so there's some critical differences, I think, when you think about meat and dairy and how it's produced and the kinds of things that we ingest when we have an industrial system versus one that is, you know, good to the animals and also produced without a lot of antibiotics or, you know, hormone disruptors and things like that. So I just wanted to add that in there.
Okay, Ursula, there seems to be differing views here. There's a nutritional difference or there isn't.
You can talk about lots of reasons why one might be better than another, but in terms of nutrients, measuring nutrients is a completely, totally standardized methodology. It's not done by 100 different methods and 100 different interpretations. It's a little guy in a white coat in a laboratory with an agreed method to measure this nutrient. And yes, there are differences, as I say, slight differences between conventional and organic. And that is probably linked to the fact that conventional crops are often faster growing. So in effect, you're diluting the nutrient content. So per 100 grams, you get slight differences. But it also depends on the soil quality, where it's grown.
Which could be different for both organic and for non-organic.
There are lots of differences. Yeah, okay. But in terms of omega-3 fatty acids in grass-fed milk versus feedlot-fed milk, there are differences, and grass-fed does have higher amounts, but those differences are trivial in relation to the amount of omega-3 you get from eating a sardine, for example. Okay. So there are differences, but they're all relatively minor on the scale of nutrients.
Okay, let's park that for a minute and let's look at the concept of cost again. And I don't want to take this too far, but the government's behavioural insights team have proposed a sustainability levy on meat. I presume that would mean that sustainably raised meat would end up having a cost benefit from this, and that feedlot raised meat would have a negative cost problem. So is this applicable, do you think? What do you reckon? Is this workable?
I think at the moment there are two options out there. One is a sustainability approach, which the Behavioural Insights team appear to be coming at it from. And then the other one is a straightforward meat tax. And I think I would say a meat tax is not the way to go, because it doesn't apply a nuanced approach to what is meat and how has it been farmed. I think a sustainability approach, possibly alongside regulation and subsidy changes, I think that would be interesting. I think any way we can try and get people off this conventional, chemical-heavy approach to farming is going to be a good thing.
Mm. Okay. Shefali, what do you think?
Yeah, I was looking at the report, actually, and I had some questions about it, in the sense that I totally agree with Jimmy. I think you need a set of things. You need regulations. You need to change the subsidy regime. And I think you could have some sort of a sustainability kind of system, but we have to figure out who the polluters are, who's paying. Because right now, at least in the report that I was looking at that was, you know, explaining the whole sustainability approach, I didn't see a whole lot of mention of that big elephant in the room. I saw producers and I saw consumers paying for it. And I think it's really critical to see, you know, who are we identifying as the polluters? There's a reason why farmers are producing the way that they're producing, and it's because there's very few, very powerful buyers in the market, and they control the price. And are those buyers internalizing these costs? And so I think there are some important questions that I have about such a thing, but I think it's workable. I think if we include producers on the front line, and consumers to help, you know, with a bottom-up approach, come up with a sustainability type of policy, I would support it for sure.
Okay, now we've been talking for far too long, and we ought to draw this to a close. But I think we should go back to the initial title of this podcast, which is The Future of Meat. We've been talking about what ought to happen or what could happen. Can we just kind of get a quick view from all of the panelists about what they think is going to happen, whether it's good or bad? So if we look at, I mean, let's take a reasonable guess, like for 20 years, what do you think is going to happen? Maybe it might be your wildest dreams, or it might be your worst nightmares. Let's start off with Jimmy. In 20 years' time, what do you think will be the state of meat?
I think you're going to see a lot more less and better. I think pasture fed is going to be in people's minds more than it is at the moment. I also think that lab grown synthetic meat is going to take some of the market which industrial meat occupies at the moment. I think largely, you know, I have a background in the food industry. I think food producers and businesses buy on cost and ease of production, and I think that is going to fit them perfectly. And I think a lot of consumers at the moment aren't really aware of where their food or meat is coming from, so they may not be be none wiser. But I do think we're going to see a growth, hopefully meaningful growth, in sustainable pasture-fed meat.
And do you think that's about the knowledge about blockchain technology telling us the truth about where it's come from and tracking its path?
I think that will help. But again, sending a consumer to a farm webpage doesn't necessarily give them all the information they need. I think, you know, we do, you know, I guess while I can see the problems with certification about producing an in or out kind of metric, which doesn't necessarily tell you all the truth. Mm. I think some form of centralized sustainability review of a farm is going to be important if we're expecting consumers to look at the farms and think that's good or bad.
Ursula?
Well, I definitely think that total meat consumption will be going down for all sorts of reasons beyond just fashionability, which might be the claim at the moment. But that gap has to be filled, and that has to be filled to some degree with boring old beans and lentils, which no one talks about because they're not as exciting as the lab meats, but clearly fill the function of providing protein and nutrients. But I think also populations will continue to become discerning, although the fact that we are now increasingly urbanized means that there will forever be a gap between consumers of foods and producers of foods. And we like to say we're interested in which farm and which cow, but in reality, there is just that distance. And we just have to have confidence in the regulators, in government systems to just verify and check the safety and accuracy of the foods that we're buying in our shops.
Okay. Shefali, the future of meat in terms of policy? Give me the 20-year view.
Well, in the next 10 years, I see that there's going to be some serious climatic changes that is going to impact how food is grown. I think that's only going to increase in the next 20 years. And governments will have to adjust accordingly. So I think there will be a huge movement that is there now for the food sovereignty movement that is saying, look, we need to create more resilient food and farming systems. And for that, we need all kinds of support. And I think that movement is gonna grow louder. And I think we'll see evidence that we actually do need biodiverse systems. We need to bring more genetic diversity, more diversity in our food production to be able to weather the storm, no pun intended, and to meet the climate crisis that we're facing and the food security needs that we're going to have to meet. And I would agree. I think in the urban areas, this awareness that perhaps we are consuming too much, and hopefully my hope is that how we're, that the awareness about how that food is produced is also going to improve dramatically in the next 10 years or so.
Okay, that sounds pretty good. Okay, Patrick, you get the last gasp. As with your Sustainable Food Trust CEO hat on, 20 years down the line, what is meat going to look like?
Well, I think the current pandemic is very revealing. The supermarket shelves are being emptied by panic buying, indicating an underlying concern about food security. Though I would say, in answer to the question, how much meat should we eat and what kind of meat? We should eat the meat that can be produced by the farmers in our region or nation in the proportions that it would be produced under a fully sustainable regime and adjust our diets accordingly. And if that was to happen, we would cut out chicken altogether. That would be an occasional treat. No industrial chicken, no industrial pork, no dairy products from mega dairies, but actually more sustainably produced, mainly grass-fed red meat, because that is consistent with the productive capacity of the United Kingdom under sustainable management. It's worth noting that two-thirds of the agricultural land in the UK is grass and pasture. We don't want to plough that up because that will release carbon. Instead, we need to farm in harmony with nature in a welfare-friendly way and then eat accordingly.
Well, well said, all of you. Thank you very, very much for all of your input. I think this is fascinating. We could actually just carry on talking about this for days because the future of meat is such a vast concept. But we have to stop there. So all I need to do is to say thank you very much to Shefali Sharma from the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, Ursula Ahrens, member of the British Dietetic Association, Patrick Holden, founder and chief exec of the Sustainable Food Trust, and Jimmy Woodrow, representing the Pasture Fed Livestock Association. Thank you so much, everyone, for your time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.